Welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis. The first article is on biological diversity, and this is written by Michael Paulson of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, a Washington correspondent. Dateline Washington, from the lowliest lichens to the fearsome grizzly bear, much of the diverse flora and fauna of the Northwest is in decline because of the side effects of human civilization, the government said yesterday. The U.S. Geological Survey, releasing what it said was the first large-scale assessment of trends among the nation's biological resources, found dramatic declines in the country's plants, animals, and ecosystems. The construction of cities and farms, the consumption of water for industry and agriculture, global warming, chemical pollution, and even a history of transporting plants and animals from one continent to another all are cited by the report as ways in which human beings have contributed to a reduction in biological diversity in the United States. Man's impact on the Earth is accelerating, said Charles Grote, the director of the USGS. We continue to experience population growth, urban sprawl, and heavy use of natural resources from lands to waters to air and living creatures. In fact, we will see more and more pressure on all of our biological systems. The conclusions of the report are not new. The document is a compilation of scientific research conducted in the public and private sectors over the last few decades. But they are nonetheless striking in their scope. In the Pacific Northwest, the report says, logging of old-growth forests has dramatically affected a wide variety of birds and plants west of the Cascades. East of the Cascades, decades of fire suppression and heavy grazing have transformed the landscape. The big picture is fairly familiar. At least 83% of the Northwest's old-growth Douglas fir forests are gone, as are 75% of the coastal rainforests of Washington, and some creatures, the northern spotted owl and Pacific salmon in particular, have become familiar symbols of conflict between economic and environmental values. The report highlights the breadth of creatures that have declined over the past few centuries. Washington state officials have been unable to find leopard frogs in parts of eastern Washington where they were once abundant. Sharp-tailed snakes, ring-neck snakes, western rattlesnakes, and common king snakes have virtually disappeared from Oregon's southern Willamette Valley. The winter wren, the golden-crowned kinglet, and Wilson's warbler, three birds found in old-growth forests, seem to be in decline, as is the marten, a small furry relative of the weasel. Similar problems can be found throughout the country. The report found that less than 1% of the native grassland that once covered the seven prairie states still remains. Grassland birds are in decline, and prairie dog populations have fallen by 98%. The report blames dams and other water uses for the fact that fish and other aquatic organisms dominate lists of species at risk. For example, the southeastern United States, where 19% of freshwater fish are endangered or threatened, while in the southwest, 48% of the region's fish species are in trouble. The report does offer some good news about the Northwest. Otters, once hunted into oblivion at the turn of the century, have rebounded since the 1970s. A hardy population of sea otters can now be found between Macaw Bay and Destruction Island in Washington. Bald eagles and various raptors are also on the rebound, in part thanks to the banning of the pesticide DDT. The Oregon silver spot butterfly population, which we read about just a few minutes ago, has stabilized after a long decline. That's not what I read in that article. And some species have adapted well to humans and their activities, including two types of birds, stellar jays and common yellowthroats, and mammals such as coyotes, red foxes, and black bear. Nature has shown, at least in the case of natural disaster, a dramatic ability to restore itself. The report points to the eruption of Mount St. Helens and the destruction of Hurricane Andrew as examples of ways in which a disaster can boost biological diversity. The distribution of sediment to coastal wetlands by Andrew and the toppling of trees by the St. Helens volcano have provided opportunities for different species to move into the area. If you want to view the report, you can order the report at www.usgs.gov. We're going to move to our commentary. This is by Earth First commentary provider Oak. So let's check out his latest commentary called Jet Skis Suck.
Jet skis suck. It's as simple as that. Other than luxury cars, SUVs, warplanes, misdirected bulldozers, and giant earth gougers, I can't think of another driving machine as obnoxious as the Sea-Doo jet ski or water bike. Those macho personal watercraft aren't just loud and dangerous. They're a threat to the aquatic environment as well. That may be of little concern to the thrill-seekers who actually buy or rent those idiotic machines. A recent ad for Sea-Doos out New England way proclaimed, "Ride all day, the water has all night to recover." Cute, huh? It's morons like that who lend credence to the suspicion that many motorized RV users can't walk and think at the same time. Besides the 85 to 105 decibel ear-splitting racket and control-compromising speeds in excess of 65 miles per hour, the personal watercraft emits 8 times more pollution than equivalent motorboats. It's reported that a 2-hour ride on a 100-horsepower jet ski emits the same pollution as driving 139,000 miles in a late-model car. That's over 46 trips across country. Turn in your license, buddy. You've used up your share. In addition to the air and water pollution caused by jet skis, wildlife takes a beating as well. While Joey gets his rocks off pulling donuts and figure eights, critters from loons to migrating humpback whales are often harassed or injured in the offing. There's simply no need for such nonsense. Jet skis are just plain dumb. If you'd like to see or hear fewer of these infernal machines, there are some things you can do short of monkey wrenching them yourself. Did I say that? Earth Island Institute's Blue Water Network has a campaign going to keep jet skis out of the public waterways. Why not give them a call? Now, get your pencils ready. At 415-788-3666. Or check their website at www.earthisland.org/BW. Anyway, that's the view from this oak for Earth First Radio.
And Oak will be back with more commentaries next week here on Earth First Radio. Let's move into genetic engineering news. Britain's mammoth experiment to test whether genetically modified crops pose a greater threat to wildlife than conventional varieties has been thrown into disarray. In an embarrassing climb down, the government has admitted that the latest crops to be sown were planted illegally. If judges now order the crops to be plowed up, the disruption could seriously delay the 4-year, £3 million trial. The latest twist to Britain's GM crop controversy surrounds winter oilseed rape, or canola, produced by the German company Agrivo and planted at 4 farms in central England. In March, Agrivo won consent to plant GM spring oilseed rape as part of the government's trials, but instead of ordering the company to submit a fresh application to plant the winter crop, as European Union rules require, the government allowed the plantings to go ahead by approving alterations and additions to the spring consent. Peter Broderick, lawyer with Friends of the Earth, which has campaigned against genetic modification plantings, spotted the infringement and asked the High Court to rule on the matter. Michael Meacher, the environmental minister, last week conceded that the GM winter oilseed rape had been illegally planted and announced that the government would not contest the case. Amazingly, this is the 3rd time that the government has been forced to admit to having violated its own rules concerning genetically modified crops. Friends of the Earth accuses it of colluding with the biotechnology companies to drive the trials forward. How can people trust the government when they allow the rules to be bent this way, Roderick says. The Cabinet Office, which coordinates government policy on genetic engineering, rejects this charge. Quote, "It's not the government waving this through on a nod," says the spokeswoman. "It was a mistake by a civil servant." Sounds like the whole thing is a big mistake to Uncle Dennis. Friends of the Earth is now considering whether to ask the High Court to order the offending winter crops to be plowed up. The government says it would appeal against any such judgment. Whether or not the winter plantings are destroyed, the latest ruling adds to a catalog of embarrassment for the British government. A year ago, it admitted waiving the procedures under which new crops, both GM and conventional, are supposed to be assessed, not for environmental purposes, but for quality and uniqueness in more than 1,200 cases since 1995. Including 163 of transgenic plants. More recently, it conceded that it had similarly short-circuited procedures for approving sales of genetically modified and other new varieties of seeds. In both these cases, the law was amended retrospectively to accommodate the infringements, and we thank the New Scientist in their 25th September issue for this information. And in other news, an anonymous Minnesota group calling itself the Bolt Weevils destroyed corn at the Novartis seed research field and glued locks at the company's corporate offices in Golden Valley. This latest direct action against genetic engineering in the biotechnology industry marks the sixth in a series of transgenic crop sabotages in the United States since November of 1998. And moving to international news, the New Zealand Labour Party announced Friday that if it wins the government election due later this year, it will stop all logging of rainforests on public lands on the west coast of New Zealand's South Island. The Labour Party announcement was a setback for the publicly owned logging company Timberlands West Coast, which had hired the PR firm Shandwick New Zealand to run a multi-million dollar lobbying campaign designed to win approval for its rainforest logging plans. The campaign was described in one of its internal strategy documents as designed to neutralize its environmental opponents. The Labour Party announced that if it forms government, it will end the Rimu logging in rainforests on public land, and the trials Timberlands proposed for new logging schemes based on beech trees will also be stopped. That sounds like a good deal for the forests of at least western South Island, New Zealand. And moving to Nicaragua, President Orlando Alemán's recent decision to cancel the moratorium on the cutting and exporting of mahogany and other threatened tropical hardwood species has been a cause for great alarm among Nicaraguan environmentalists. Your letters are urgently needed to encourage the protection of Nicaragua's threatened forest. The fate of Nicaragua's people and its forests are inextricably intertwined, although deforestation is not often prioritized as an urgent social issue. Its results include climatic changes, droughts, drinking water shortages, crop losses and malnutrition, soil erosion, flooding, sedimentation that destroys marine resources, fuel wood shortages, and ultimately increased poverty and potential for military conflicts. These connections were made painfully clear during Hurricane Mitch, when landslides on the deforested slopes of Nicaragua and Honduras led to great losses of crops, fertile soils, and human life. Despite rampant deforestation of recent decades, Nicaragua still retains the largest extent of rainforest of any of the Central American nations. And what are they going for? Well, it's mahogany. Mahogany is one of the tallest trees in the Nicaraguan rainforest. Its umbrella-shaped crown reaches over 200 feet high and emerges above the surrounding canopy. The use of mahogany dates back to pre-Columbian times, when indigenous peoples of the Americas used the durable and beautiful wood for dugout canoes. And what can you do about it? Well, write to Nicaraguan President Arnoldo Alemán, A-R-N-O-L-D-O, Alemán, A-L-E-M-A-N, Casa Presidencial, Avenida Bolivar, Managua, Nicaragua. I'll repeat that address. Nicaraguan President Arnoldo Alemán, Casa Presidencial, Avenida Bolivar, Managua, Nicaragua. All right, if you want to send him a fax, it is the telephone number here in the States is 011-505-228-7911. That fax number again, 011-505-228-7911. And be sure to include in your fax the following information. Let's see here. Stop the logging is the first one. It seems I may have lost a page here. Anyway, stop the logging. It's unsustainable plunder of natural resources for short-term survival will not prevail. Number two, reinstate the logging ban with effective law enforcement this time. The Nicaraguan government and lending and development agencies need to financially support a commitment to enforcing the logging ban. And three, the need to create a workable forest policy with input from civil society. So get your letter on down there to Nicaragua. Moving back here to the United States, logging in roadless areas continues to be the mainstay of the Forest Service timber sale program in Idaho. With 47 new projects launched since the road building moratorium was announced 20 months ago, a roadless area timber sale inventory by the Idaho Conservation League found 95 prospective logging projects in roadless areas today, compared with 107 roadless projects 2 years ago. The report found that 26 projects remain on hold until after the road moratorium is lifted or permanent policy is in place, and that the moratorium may have played a part in 41 roadless projects that required road construction which have been dropped in the last 2 years. Well, that's good news. There will be some town hall meetings, and I read about those earlier. Okay, so we'll get on to that. In the largest conservation land buy in the history of the Chesapeake Bay watershed, the Conservation Fund, the State of Maryland, and the Richard King Mellon Foundation have acquired 76,000 acres of the three-state Delmarva Peninsula in Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia. Maryland purchased 29,000 acres, the largest land deal in state history. It cost them $16.5 million. The Mellon Foundation purchased another 29,000 Maryland acres for sustainable forestry, but eventually will donate the lands to the state. The Conservation Fund bought 9,000 acres each in Delaware and Virginia. The lands purchased from the Hancock Timber Resource Group include woodlands, freshwater, and brackish wetlands that provided habitat for native plant and animal species. Not only will these acquisitions enhance water quality and protect wildlife habitat, but they also benefit the residents and communities throughout the Delmarva Peninsula, said Conservation Fund Chairman Patrick Noonan. That sounds like good stuff. And in the Green Wildlands newsletter sent to us from the Grassroots Environmental Effectivist Network, here's their edition. A wetland destruction in Virginia is one of the greatest threats to the health of Chesapeake Bay. The Foundation's State of the Bay report reports, Virginia has lost or soon will lose nearly 9,000 acres of wetlands as a result of a federal appeals court ruling last year, said Joseph Maroon, Virginia Executive Director of the Foundation. The Tulloch decision last year upheld federal restrictions against filling wetlands, but said draining of wetlands is still allowed under current law. Since the decision, developers in southeast Virginia have been draining wetlands to prepare for development. It's a double whammy, said Foundation spokesman Chuck Eppes. We're losing the natural wetland function and exacerbating the problem by putting development on the property. And Georgia Governor Roy Barnes announced that he intends to use money from the state's budget surplus to purchase environmentally sensitive land adjacent to the Chattahoochee River. According to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, this land buyup marks the second phase of a program to create a 180-mile greenway along the river. Preserving the banks of the Chattahoochee is an integral part of the governor's plan announced last month at a National Governor's Conference to encourage fast-growing counties to set aside 20% of their undeveloped land as open space. And the Arizona Game and Fish Commission has banned predator contest hunts after months of pressure from grassroots activists, according to the Arizona Daily Star. The rule bans body count contest hunts statewide of predatory animals, fur-bearing animals, and non-game animals. Of the 11,927 comments received by the commission on the issue, 10,702 were in support of the ban. Many of the comments recognize the important role that predators play in maintaining healthy ecosystems. Camilla Fox of the Animal Protection Institute said this is the first time the Arizona Game and Fish Commission has sided with the non-hunting public. The only reason they voted in support of the ban was because of public pressure. All right, moving to Hawaii. The Haleakala National Park on the Hawaiian island of Maui was named one of the National Park Conservation Association's top 10 most endangered parks a few months ago. It is home to more endangered and threatened species than any other national park. This is one of the main reasons the National Park Conservation Association and other environmental groups have been alarmed at plans to expand the island's Kahului Airport, 15 miles from the park's border. The proposal, which includes extending the airport's runway from 7,400 to 9,600 feet, would allow regular international traffic to begin at the airport. International flights bring with them the acute danger of introductions of alien species, such as the notorious brown tree snake. Certain species, such as the snake, accidentally introduced on other tropical islands, have had devastating effects on the native ecosystems, including extinctions of many native species. In response to the Federal Aviation Administration's approval of the Kahului Airport expansion, the National Park Conservation Association has filed a legal petition for review before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. The court has just announced that oral arguments will be heard on November 3rd. The National Park Conservation Association is challenging the agency on the National Transportation Act and the Airport and Airways Improvement Act, as they have not fulfilled their responsibility in protecting public parkland from the threat of alien species. National Park Conservation Association is continuing to work with the local community and Maui Malama Pono as co-plaintiff. And Kentucky mining permits violate federal rules. Environmental regulators in Kentucky have approved numerous mountaintop removal mining permits that violate federal rules, the Federal Office of Surface Mining reported Tuesday. The agency report says Kentucky has largely ignored environmental factors like the stability and drainage of piles of mined earth. Right, the Office of I wanted to shorten this up a little bit. The result of these practices is that a greater extent of watersheds was affected than would have been necessary, the report said. The permanent loss of headwaters and streams would be reduced if the fill construction would be restricted to the upper portion of the watershed and then progress down the drainage only when necessary. Finally, the OSM says Kentucky regulators should require permit applicants to demonstrate that waste from the proposed mine will not vary in any way that adversely affects the ecology of any surface water or any existing or planned use of surface or groundwater. All right. Things are heating up in eastern mining. Moving out to Idaho, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal issued a rare order against Idaho District Court in bitter battle against conservationists, county commissioners, the timber industry, and the U.S. Forest Service. In a slugfest pitting the lightweight public interest group against heavyweights, timber industries, county commissioners, and U.S. Forest Service, defended by the largest law firm in the world, the United States Justice Department, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals yesterday awarded the first round to the underdog. That court halted almost all logging on the entire Boise National Forest, including the Macpine Paradise Prince John Myrtle timber sales, until it can hear the appeal of the Idaho Sporting Congress of Idaho District Court's Magistrates Mickle Williams' July ruling that the logging could proceed. The court stay of the 29.2 million board feet of timber was a historic order, since the Ninth Circuit has never before granted one in a logging-related case in Idaho, and they're rarely issued. Odds of getting one are about 5%, and this means the justices are extremely alarmed with the facts and the law of this case, said Ron Mitchell, Idaho Sporting Congress Executive Director. ISC charges the Forest Service is failing to protect old-growth forests and their dependent sensitive wildlife and fish species on the entire 2.3 million-acre Boise National Forest, an area larger than Yosemite National Park. Well, that's it for Earth First Radio News today. To get news announcements and comments from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, please send us email at cruzef@cruzio.com. That's CRUZEF at CRUZIO.com, cruzef@cruzio.com. And send letters, donations, or CDs, cassettes, or anything else friendly to Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. That's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Please send those announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. If you'd like more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, subscribe to the Earth First Journal. They're at P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. That's the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. Earth First Radio is broadcast live on Free Radio Santa Cruz 96.3 FM every Thursday at 8 p.m., or you can listen to Earth First Radio anytime you want on your computer. Just dial up the World Wide Web at radioforall.web.net. That's radioforall, the number 4, .web.net. You'll need a sound card, but the software you need is free on the website. Earth First Radio is being rebroadcast by a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. If you found us on the web, ask your local station to download and rebroadcast Earth First Radio. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney from the CD Keep It Wild. Earth First Radio is affiliated with the Earth First Radio Network. I'm Uncle Dennis, and thank you very much for listening. Please tune in again. And we're going to head out on a little musical break here. This is a song from Dana Lyons. The CD is Cows with Guns. And the tune, the Native Forest Song.
When the trees are gone, who will brush against the sky? And when their leaves are gone, will there be any birds to fly? When the forest disappears, Will there be any place to hide for the owl and the bear? Is there anything left behind? So today we end the silence and speak out for the trees. We'll save the native forests of America. People across the land, now we take a stand to see the native forests live forever. And for the 1,000-year-old fir, is this the final hour? And for the redwood and the cedar, will they feel the chainsaw's power? And in just 20 years, will our children read in books about the ancient forests and wonder how they looked? So today we end the silence and speak out for the trees. We'll save the native forests of America. People across the land, now we take a stand to see the native forests live forever. And for the life or death of forests, who will make the choice? And for all the threatened species, who will raise their voice? In all climates and all countries, will we sing in many tongues for the waters of the forest, for the air that fills our lungs? So today we end the silence and speak out for the trees. Save the native forests of America. People across the land, now we take a stand to see the native forests live forever. The native forests live forever.